right. Well, hello there.
Oh, yeah.
Just a minute or so after 5 p.m. on a balmy Friday evening. Time for American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Tom Ryan. With me, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan.
I want to rock.
We are here doing this every Wednesday and Friday between 5 and 6. And a few weeks back, we started a brand spanking new topic for our How Music Changed series. In the Wayback Machine, we've been covering Bing Crosby. Namely, mostly, this is going to be focusing on his early years when he was most relevant. This is part 4 in that series, at the point where Bing begins to break out on his own and become a solo star in his own right. Up until this point, we've been covering his time with Paul Whiteman and such, and with the Rhythm Boys. Let's get right into it with the track that he's recorded with Gus Arnheim, who was the music conductor for the Coconut Grove, which is where Bing was working at this point in time, and then they had done a few recordings. This track is called Thanks to You. Track is called Thanks to You, but you could say that thanks to Gus Arnheim, Bing's solo career was well on its way and in good hands. I mean, on a song like that, what you're hearing is basically Bing proving that a song could be conveyed with a style that transcends the sheet music. And this what was very important at this point in time, because this is at a time when sheet music sales was what was driving the music industry. All of a sudden now, it was about the performance, the recording of the song, more than the sheet music, and it was a significant change, and Bing was at the forefront of it. Unfortunately, in his personal life, though, things were not faring quite as well. I'm going to be reading segments here from Gary Gidden's wonderful book called Bing Crosby, A Pocket Full of Dreams, as we pick up. Bing's wife, Dixie, was thrilled at his progress, but distraught at the state of their marriage. In the 2 months since she returned from New York, Dixie exhausted herself trying to keep up with his nightlife while doing justice to her own career. On March 4th, just 2 days after the Thanks to You session, she announced her intention to file for divorce.
Uh-oh.
We had been married only about 6 months, she told an Associated Press reporter, but we have already found out that we are not suited to each other. Our separation is an amicable one, and the only reason for it is that we just can't get along. Amicable it was, for the simple reason that she neglected to inform Bing.
Whoopsie.
Who learned that she was charging mental cruelty when Everett phoned to read him the newspaper account. Dixie vanished, and Bing didn't know her whereabouts for 10 days until a friend persuaded her to call him from her hideout in Agua Caliente. Bing had been drinking and carousing again, but that was not the primary issue for Dixie. The intolerable thing was that she never saw him. At first, she traipsed about with him every night, staying late at the Grove and then moving on to the Cotton Club and other places, over-imbibing and not much enjoying it. Dixie was 19 and wanted her husband, not the party swirling around him. Dixie, realizing that she could not live both of their lives, made an agreement with Bing. He would not go to her job and she would not go to his. They would meet on weekends. But Bing often preferred to spend that time playing golf or baseball. There were nights he stayed out till the small hours while she waited up, a nervous wreck, taking one drink and then another in the vain hope of getting to sleep. Another source of contention was his gambling, an unlikely habit for a man later known for his financial prudence, but one that in those years consumed his income. Putting aside his fear of flying, Bing chartered a single-engine plane and headed for the Mexican playground where they had spent weekends at the track and casino. Dixie was amazed that he was willing to board such a contraption and was moved by his entreaties. But she was now in the catbird seat and made a fateful bargain, demanding that he quit drinking and take control of his life. The Agua Caliente Pact became part of Crosby family lore. According to Bob Crosby, Dixie made Bing's career possible when she weaned him off alcohol. Yet, the weaning was a 2-year process, and at the end of that time, Dixie would be fighting her own battle with booze. Bob conceded the devastating impact her drinking had on her health and her relationship with Bing, but steadfastly maintained, "It was, to me, one of the finest marriages that I have ever seen. You couldn't escape feeling the love between the two of them." Bing promised to reform, and despite several slips during the next couple of years, so successfully took control of his drinking problem that it all but disappeared. Until this point, his story threatened to turn into a prototype for the plight of music's slow suicides, from Bix Beiderbecke and Charlie Parker to Hank Williams and Elvis Presley. But Bing's tale took a radical turn. He would achieve a complete personal reversal, exercising jurisdiction over every minute of his day. As a result, most of Bing's friends endorsed his belief that, unlike Dixie and his sons, he was never truly alcoholic, because true alcoholics do not remain casual drinkers as Bing did, nursing a scotch for hours or enjoying an occasional blowout with no disruptive effects. They chalked up his hell-raising days to the culture of prohibition and paraphrased St. Augustine's reflection, "Our real pleasure was simply in doing something that was not allowed." Yet Bing had displayed undeniable symptoms of clinical alcoholism, blackouts and binges and self-destructive conduct. In time, the years 1927 to 31 would represent to him the abandoned period of his wildness, an alcoholic maze that devoured one Bing Crosby and delivered another. Dixie's decree inaugurated his transformation, yet like many who possess a genius for self-control, Bing was impatient with those who did not. Meanwhile, if Bing had good reason to believe in luck, having fallen upward every step of his career, he now had reason to marvel at rehabilitation, for suddenly grand doors were opening. The first of three powerful gatekeepers was the smart and daring record producer Jack Capp, a genial businessman with an unerring memory for names and faces who knew every facet of the record business. In 1934, he would create Decca Records and transform the industry, but in 1931, he was general manager for the Brunswick label, building an imposing roster. The Mills Brothers, Boswell Sisters, Victor Young, Cab Calloway, Glenn Gray, Duke Ellington, and his personal favorite, Guy Lombardo. In March, Bing engaged an established entertainment lawyer, who, along with Everett, prevailed upon Cap to listen to a few of Bing's Arnheim recordings, one of which we just heard. Cap already knew Bing's singing from the Whiteman days and did not need persuading. He signed him to a six-month contract with a renewal option favoring the company, which was then controlled by Warners. A couple of weeks later, Cap traveled to California to supervise his first Crosby session recording, Out of Nowhere. Let's hear that track now.
You came to me from out of nowhere. You took my heart and found it free. Wonderful dreams, wonderful schemes from nowhere. Made every hour sweet as a flower to me. And if you should go back to your nowhere, leaving me with a memory, I'll always wait for your return out of nowhere, hoping you'll bring your love to me. When I least expected, kindly fate directed you to make each dream of mine come true. And if it's clear or raining, there is no explaining. Things just happen, and so did you. You came to me from out of nowhere. You took my heart and you found it free. Wonderful dreams, wonderful schemes from nowhere. Made every hour sweet as a flower to me. And if you should go back to your nowhere, leaving me with my memory, I'll always wait for your return out of nowhere, hoping you'll bring your love to me.
Well, first of all, you can immediately hear the change in style as Crosby becomes a solo artist.
Oh, yeah.
All of a sudden, it is indisputably Bing Crosby on lead vocal there. And, of course, he doesn't have to wait a full 90 seconds to 2 minutes before he makes his entrance because he is the artist top billed, the artist on the record. By April, Out of Nowhere was a top-selling record, the first released under Bing's name.
Awesome.
Now, two other songwriters, Sam Coswell and Arthur Johnston, play into the next track, as they were mostly writing songs for theater assignments and movies. In this instance, here's how they tell it. According to Sam Coswell, the song Just One More Chance originated when his partner Arthur Johnston came up with the title and four suitable notes. The next phrase popped into my brain like a flash, he said. They discussed the futility, though, of writing a song without an assignment. They couldn't figure out what to do because they didn't have a movie to attach it to.
Oh.
And Johnston suggested that they fashion it for a singer, not a production. How about Bing? They tailored the melody to his croony ballad style. Bing, who loved it, rehearsed with Johnston and then introduced the song on an afternoon radio show called Musical Cocktail. He sang it again that night on the Coconut Grove broadcast. The impact was incredible. Clubgoers demanded encores and radio fans besieged stores for a record that didn't exist.
Crazy.
Eventually, of course, released soon afterward. Here is that track, Just One More Chance.
Just one more chance to prove it you alone I care for. Each night I say a little prayer for. Just one more chance. Just one more night to taste the kisses that enchant me. I'd want no others if you'd grant me just one more chance. I've learned the meaning of repentance. Now you're the jury at my trial. I know that I should serve my sentence. Still I'm hoping all the while you will give me just one more word. I said that I was glad to start out, but now I'm back to cry my heart out for just one more chance. We spend our lives in groping for happiness. I found it once and tossed it aside. I've paid for it with hours of loneliness. I've nothing to hide. I'd bury my pride for.
Suited his life story.
Right. Well, after Rush recording that track, Just One More Chance easily outsold the track we played previously, Out of Nowhere, dominating sales in June of 1931, until eventually it was surpassed by two more Crosby hits in July, followed by another in August, two more in September, four more in October.
Wow.
And so it went. Bing would continue to average 16 charted singles per year, right on up through 1950. Peaking in 1939 with 27, a feat that was broken only by the Beatles in 1964 when they charted
Crazy.
With 30. Bing was about to become the defining voice of his era. And for many people, this was the salvo that announced his revival. It did for him in 1931 what All or Nothing at All would do for Frank Sinatra in 1943, or what Heartbreak Hotel would do for Presley in 56. I Want to Hold Your Hand for the Beatles in 1964. Meanwhile, films were beckoning. Max Sennett, who discovered or directed most of the great silent screen comedians, Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, Fatty Arbuckle, had recently made a distribution deal with Paramount's Adolf Zukor. Like every other producer, he was looking for actors with good voices. A singer with comic timing was a godsend. If Bing wanted to cut loose from the Rhythm Boys, though, he was not as much. He was not admitting as much to himself or them. Just as he had insisted that Sam Coslow find roles for Al and Henry in his last film, he attempted to involve them in the Senate films. The letter he received from Senate's assistant general manager in 1931 confirmed an agreement for an option on the services of all three in a picture to go into production on or before June 15. It stipulated that Senate had 15 days to exercise the option, and that the three men would be paid $1,000 a week while engaged in the production. Bing signed Rhythm Boys by Bing Crosby, and Al and Harry initialed the letter on May 20th, a Wednesday. But why Harry and Al did not participate in these two reelers is not known. Perhaps they were tiring of the back seat and did not want supporting roles in vehicles created around Bing. Rinker never commented on the decision except to describe Bing's acceptance of Senate's proposal as a wise decision and admit that the group's demise was, quote, a relief to me, unquote. In any case, Senate and Bing renegotiated the contract to their mutual benefit, amending the price from $1,000 for the trio to $600 for Bing. Excuse me, I jump forward a bit. I don't have to jump through the book, so if there's any awkward moments, please pardon that. It's not the writer, it's me. Anyway, what Cap and Senate had done for Bing on records and in movies, William S. Paley could accomplish on network radio. The prize was a nightly 15-minute show that would be relayed by the network all over the country. A CBS representative offered Bing an audition with the proviso that he'd come to New York, but Bing had qualms about making the trip. He was beginning to realize his Hollywood dreams and did not want to be apart from Dixie. Yet, when word got back that Russ Colombo was pursuing the same course, Bing agreed to give it a shot. For his resourcefulness, Everett was officially signed on as Bing's manager. Yet, Paley had never received Everett's package. While Bing was ruminating about the audition, the CBS chief was on board the SS Europa en route to the continent. On his third day at sea, or so it was related in a press release, Paley heard "I Surrender, Dear" wafting from the stateroom of a fellow passenger. He ascertained the name of the singer and radioed his New York office for information. Paley instructed Columbia to sign Crosby for a sustaining show at $1,500, a remarkable sum for a show subsidized by the network in the hope of luring a sponsor. In later years, Paley would embellish the story, making it a near-perfect match for Max Sennett's. The CBS underlings tell him he's crazy, but he overrules them and mandates a contract. Bing was signed to a 15-minute show, Monday through Saturday. The routine would be three vocals, one instrumental by the band, and no talk except for the network's announcer. Excuse me. 2 weeks preceding the broadcast were busy ones for Bing, who had not been back to New York in 15 months. A few days after his arrival, he was booked by Jack Capp for a three-hour session that proved momentous on two counts. Bing worked for the first time with Victor Young, the conductor and composer soon to emerge as one of Hollywood's finest music directors, and someone with whom he developed a particularly close and lasting rapport. And he was paired with two important songs that he forged into all-time standards. Stardust, Bing was the first to record Mitchell Parrish's lyric to Hoagie Carmichael's magical Bix-like melody, verse, and chorus, and Dancing in the Dark from Bandwagon. Let's hear Dancing in the Dark right now.
Dancing in the dark till the tune ends, we're dancing in the dark. And it soon ends, we're waltzing in the wonder of why we're here. Time hurries by, we're here and gone, looking for the light of a new love to brighten up the night. I have you, love, and we can face the music together, dancing.
dancing in the dark. What though love is old, what though song is old, through them we can be young. Hear this heart of mine, make yours part of mine, dear one. Tell me that we're waltzing in the wonder of why we're here. Time hurries by, we're here and gone. And we can face the music together, dancing in the dark.
Really tough song to sing that Crosby handles brilliantly there. And for somebody who's known for his deep baritone, he has to get pretty high on that one.
Oh, he's got quite the range.
Does quite a job. August 31st, 1931. A cool, dry Monday in the twilight of Prohibition, just before the bleakest years of the Depression. The two front-page stories could not have been more reflective of the times. A Brooklyn gunfight had taken the life of a teenage girl, and President Hoover was pledging to fight the payment of bonus reparations to World War I veterans. Prosperity was nowhere near the corner, but the New Deal was, and Bing, though a moderate Republican by disposition, was about to emerge as its crooning oracle. The ascendancy of Everyman Bing began on network radio with a strange and fitful birth. Bing's Monday evening 11 p.m. debut was much publicized. The Sunday New York Times Listening In column featured a large photograph of Bing and a capsule rendition of Paley's shipboard discovery. Yet, when listeners tuned in at the appointed time, they heard CBS staff announcer Lewis Dean tell the radio audience that the scheduled program would not be heard. Instead, Fred Rich and the Columbians would perform. Listeners expecting to hear Bing on Tuesday night had heard another announcer declaim a second postponement. Fletcher Henderson's band filled in this time. Finally, on Wednesday evening, September 2nd, an ebullient third announcer ended the mystery. Here is the moment you've been waiting for the delayed appearance of that sensational baritone Bing Crosby, whose singing has made him the favorite of California through the mediums of the motion picture, the vaudeville stage, and the radio. The announcer explained that the singer had recovered from a severe case of laryngitis and could now bring you his inimitable song interpretations. Thus begins Bing's radio career, although, of course, all the rumors were that he was on a binge and was unable to sing the first 2 days because of him over-imbibing.
Oopsie.
Turns out, though, that the story of him basically having laryngitis was true. But by the end of the week, affiliates were calling to inquire about Bing and to report on the excitement in their communities. Fans phoned or sent letters and wires. Requests for interviews poured in from the press. Several out-of-town editors asked to meet Bing and watch the show, although there was no studio audience. The country was suddenly mad for singers. Paley immediately added the Boswell Singers to his team, which had already included the immensely popular Morton Downey and Kate Smith. NBC could not believe it. With two networks, the red and the blue, NBC thought of itself as the invincible ruler of the air. Suddenly, Paley was crooning his baby into position as a real competitor. NBC had fired Russ Colombo on August 21st. But after being signed with CBS, NBC's vice president John Royal rehired him for a nightly show that directly followed Crosby. He advised the press, both artists are the same style singers, instigating a battle of the baritones that prefigured the Crosby and Sinatra duels of the 40s. Despite the superficial resemblance, though, Colombo was the obverse of Crosby. He was a crooner merely, a ballad singer who initially favored a tenor range and could barely handle an up-tempo number, let alone swing. If Bing represented a synthesis of jazz and pop, Columbo was a limited stylist who held his notes a tad too long. Yet, Russ echoes throughout Bing's developing years like a night wind, pursuing him in every medium, the first of many celebrated singers to consciously imitate Bing, affirming and codifying his influence. On November 6th, Crosby embarked on a 10-week stint at the Paramount Theater, the stage where he and Al Rinker had originally bombed a number of years earlier, for what turned out to be the longest streak by any entertainer in the theater's history. Midway through the engagement, Paramount renewed his contract for another 10 weeks, four more at its Broadway theater and six at the Paramount Theater in Brooklyn. When he closed in Brooklyn, Bing returned to the Broadway theater as the vocal star in a George Jessel review for an additional 3 weeks. In total, he commanded Paramount's two New York stages for 5 months without a break. During most of that time, Bing's daily grind consisted of four stage shows at $2,500 a week and two 15-minute daily broadcasts, plus various charity shows, guest appearances, recording dates, and concerts. So, despite the man's image of appearing to be lackadaisical and not busy, few people in business were as busy as Bing Crosby was and at this point in time. Variety magazine praised his professionalism. Unlike most singers, he saw an audience before he saw the inside of a radio studio. But business was not much better than average the first week. The theater manager, Jack McInerney, remembered Bing occasionally having an attack of nerves and bracing himself with a drink, though nothing like in the Rhythm Boys days, he added. McInerney recalled him as a very pleasant person, talked to the stagehands, joked with everybody, easygoing, but nervous before a show. He relaxed when the Mills Brothers, one of the most ingenious and melodious of close harmony groups, appeared for three delightful weeks. Bing never felt more at home than when surrounded by good musicians, and though he performed only one number on stage with the brothers, between shows they repaired to the steps out back and jammed. On December 16th, Bing arranged, accidentally on purpose, to record with them. Taking a busman's holiday, Bing wandered into the studio to watch the brothers rehearse. After a while, he asked to get in on a number. They ran down a routine on Dinah, a jump tune chiefly associated with Ethel Waters. Bing began fooling around, scatting. He asked the engineers to record a take simply as a test. Everybody liked it so much, a second take was made. In the first days of 1932, after released, Dinah was the hottest record in the country, the second top-ranking hit for the Mills Brothers, and the fourth for Bing. It endures as an irresistible pop classic. Here's Bing Crosby with the Mills Brothers.
Dinah, is there anyone finer in the state of Carolina? If there is, and you know her, show her to me. Dinah, got those Dixie eyes blazing, how I love to sit and gaze to the eyes of Dinah Lee. Every night, why do I shake with fright? 'Cause my dynamite change your mind about me. Oh, Dinah, could you wander to China? I would hop an ocean liner just to be with Dinah Lee.
Dinah, is there anyone finer in the state of Carolina? If there is, then you know it, show it to me. Dinah, where the Dixie eyes blazing, I would love sitting gazing to the eyes of Dinah Lee. My Dinah, every night, why should I shake with fright? Because my Dinah might change her mind about me. Dinah, if you wanted to China, I would hop an ocean liner
Every night, why do I shake with pride? 'Cause my dynamite changed her mind about me.
The name of this song is Dinah.
Said it.
The name of this song is Dinah.
Nagy.
The name of this song is Dinah.
Oh, tell it.
The name of this song is Dinah.
Dinah, wandered to China, state of Carolina.
The reason you know where I would like to have you, show it to me, Dinah. Got those Dixie eyes blazing. I want to sit and gaze into the eyes of Dinah Lee.
Oh, Dinah, should you wander to China, would give me an ocean liner just to be with Dinah Lee.
Louis Armstrong there.
Yeah, definitely a lot of Louis influence on that one. Bing with the Mills Brothers. Sounding great. Well, at this point in time, Bing focused intently on singing and rarely turned down an opportunity to work. On a Saturday evening in February, toward the end of the Paramount engagement, Bing moonlighted at New Jersey's Newark Armory at a radio artist's ball where a dollar ticket rewarded fans with Crosby, the Mills Brothers, the Boswell Sisters, Nick Lucas, the guy who was responsible for Tiptoe Through the Tulips, and Benny Kruger's orchestra. 5 evenings later, he hightailed it from his last show at the Paramount to the Columbia studio where Duke Ellington was setting up. Between midnight and 1 in the morning, they recorded 2 Ellington arrangements of W.C. Handy's St. Louis Blues.
Wow, he was keeping busy.
Getting around. Here's Bing Crosby with Duke Ellington's orchestra.
And if I'm feeling tomorrow anywhere like I feel today, oh, should I be feeling tomorrow anywhere like I feel today, I'm going to pack my trunk and make my getaway. I'll make my getaway. St. Louis woman with her diamond ring holds that gal around down by her apron string. Now if it weren't for powder and for store-bought hair, that gal I love
he wouldn't have gone so far from here. I got the St. Louis blues. I'm just as blue as I can be. Seems like that gal's got a heart like a rock cast in the sea. Or else she wouldn't have gone so far away from me. And I love my baby till the day I die.
Again, showing Louis Armstrong's influence, but popularizing it in a way that really nobody else had. Hugely influential at this point in time, Bing Crosby. Well, on April 13th, 1932, Bing, Dixie, and their terrier Cremo embarked on a five-month tour of the Paramount public circuit in an elaborate publicity drive for his first upcoming motion picture, to be entitled The Big Broadcast, which was scheduled to shoot midway through the tour, beginning on June 11th. The tour zigzagged Detroit, Chicago, Buffalo, Boston, New Haven, Chicago again, Minneapolis, St. Louis, before touching down in St. Louis. In Boston, Bing joined Jack Benny and George M. Cohan in a minstrel show and, using a pseudonym, entered an amateur talent contest at the behest of two vaudeville chums. He lost. In Chicago, Bing recorded five tunes with Isham Jones Orchestra during the first stopover and four with Frankie Trumbauer Unit during the second. Those sides produced Crosby's classic versions of other songs from the American canon, both created by black songwriters. They're coming up. Bing's performance with Isham Jones, whose dance band was studded with jazz players, including Woody Herman, is jubilant. Eddie Lang strums a two-bar transition to introduce Bang, who is loose, unhurried, letter perfect. Bing rarely begins phrases on the one, preferring to coolly syncopate them against the ensemble rhythm. No singer of that era understood as well as Bing Louis Armstrong's proclivity for superimposing implied rhythms over the stated ones. To get a feel for that, let's hear Sweet Georgia Brown right now.
Maid has got a shade on Sweet Georgia Brown. Two left feet, but oh so neat, has Sweet Georgia Brown. They all sigh and want to die, Sweet Miss Georgia Brown, and I'll tell you just why. You know that I do not lie, not much. It's been said that she knocks them dead when she lands in town. Since she came, it's a shame how she cools them down. Fellas she can't get, must be fellas that she ain't met. Georgia claimed her, Georgia named her, Sweet Georgia Brown. Thank you.
It's been said that she knocks them dead when she lands in town. Since she came, why, it's a shame how she cools them down. Fellas she can't get, must be fellas that she ain't met. Georgia claimed her, Georgia named her Sweet Georgia. They call her Sweet Miss Georgia Brown.
Three in a row with Bing scatting.
Yeah.
All the rage. Now, you have to keep in mind here something else that's pretty amazing is that the conundrum that he is facing and overcoming. Because back around this time, there was no radio and the movies were not friends. So for him to be able to basically work on both fronts was something of a miracle, something that nobody had done. And in fact, it's surprising that he was even able to attempt it at all because
one
there was such
the
animosity.
Earliest crossover stars.
Again, reading straight from the Gary Giddens book, A Pocket Full of Dreams. In 1930, fewer than a third of American homes had radios. By 1935, fewer than a third did not. The average listener spent upward of 4 hours a day beside an entertainment device that cost nothing beyond the purchase price, yet supplied constant, diverse programming. Between 30 and 32, weekly movie attendance and receipts fell by a third. Theaters offered double features and two-for-ones or half-price tickets. When those gambits failed, movie houses resorted to outright giveaways, hams, dishes, money. A Fox exhibit, a copyrighted Bank Night, a lottery to which more than 4,000 theaters subscribed. So there was a lot of competition at this point. Now, after signing Crosby, Paramount made two shrewd decisions. The first was to jettison every aspect of the original radio station setting, turning a satire instead into a variety show. Second, in presenting Bing Crosby as a character named Bing Crosby, the film took the cult of personality a step beyond established custom. So now he becomes himself pretty much in film. Bing embodied something native and new. Paramount, reeling from the Depression, banked its future on him. Despite several popular films, the studio lost nearly $16 million in 1932.
Yikes.
And in the first days of 1933, they went into receivership. After a bloodbath that consumed its production heads, the company was reorganized as Paramount Pictures. In the time between the premiere of the big broadcast at New York's Paramount and the bankruptcy hearing, the studio offered Bing a $300,000 contract for five pictures to be made over 3 years and announced that he would be star in another one entitled College Humor come spring. In December of that year, Variety reported, "Film musicals are blooming. Hollywood was beginning to understand the kind of entertainment a bowed and bleeding nation demanded. Not the Lubitsch touch, but a hearty American slap on the back." Launched by the big broadcast, Bing Crosby's career soared in a steady arc, a trajectory ascending with greater velocity every year until at its late 1940s pinnacle, he would be transformed from an actor-singer-star into an uncontestable national icon, a match for motherhood, apple pie, and baseball. Pundits would resort to epic encomiums, saluting him not untypically as the first of the universal common men. Even before then, the adulation was such that, in the recollection of his eldest son, it blurred the boundaries between, quote, God and Dad, because everybody revered both of them. His later success on all fronts was so profound it is difficult to believe that in 1932, while Paramount was preparing to launch him as a major film star, Bing thought he might be washed up on the air. His association with CBS had soured, perhaps he feared for good. His sponsor, Cremo, canceled him and he returned to Los Angeles. Bing continued to appear for CBS on a sustaining show that paid him no salary except for a default guarantee of $400 should he not have a theatrical job in any given week. Meanwhile, his theatrical appearances drew capacity crowds. He broke Jolson's house record at San Francisco's Fox Theater, taking in $40,000 for the week. On September 16, the day after he closed at the Fox, Bing recorded for the first time since May. "Please" was timed for the premiere of the big broadcast, and its punning lyric shaped a melody that ideally suited Bing's style. Let's hear that track now. Here's "Please."
lend your little ear to my pleas. Lend a ray of cheer to my pleas. Tell me that you love me too. Please, let me hold you tight in my arms. I could find delight in your charms. Every night, my whole life through, your eyes reveal that you have the soul of an angel white as snow. How long must I play the role of a gloomy Romeo? Please say you're not intending to tease. Speed that happy ending and please tell me that you love me too. Your eyes reveal that you have the soul of an angel white as snow. How long must I play the role of a gloomy Romeo? Please say you're not intending to tease. Speed that happy ending and please tell me that you love me too.
All right, with time being tight, I want to play two other tracks from this era back to back. Basically, the first track is Irving Berlin's How Deep is the Ocean? And it is basically very close to the time when Bing first was introduced to Bob Hope, the fast-talking comic and vaudevillian, then appearing on Rudy Valley's radio show. Bing's friendliness surprised and gratified Hope, and 6 weeks later they shared a bill at the Capitol Theater with Bing headlining and Bob doing the emceeing. At a session just a few days later, Bing finally decided to address the depression directly with an incredibly poignant song called Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? And we'll leave you with both of those tracks. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you next week.
Why did you let me love you? Why did you let me fall? Why should it be when it's plain to see that you can't see me at all? I need your love so badly. I love you all so madly. But I don't stand a ghost of a chance with you. I thought at last I'd found you, but other loves surround you, and I don't stand a ghost of a chance with you. If you'd surrender just for a tender kiss or two, you might discover that I'm the lover meant for you, and I'd be true. But what's the use of scheming? I know I must be dreaming, for I don't stand a ghost of a chance with you. I don't stand a ghost of a chance with you. And I don't stand a ghost of a chance with you. If you'd surrender just for a tender kiss or two, you might discover that I'm the lover meant for you, and I'd be true. But what's the use of scheming? I know I must be dreaming, for I don't stand a ghost of a chance with you. To tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with the drum. Say, don't you remember?
WHPC.